he played guitar, jamming good with Weird and
Geely. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. It's 126, Cole.
126.
As always, I am Andrew Farmer. That is Cole Houston.
Of course. Of course.
Wouldn't it be weird if you were somebody else tonight?
It would be unusual, but not uncommon.
No, it would not be uncommon. This is Cole Houston. No, I'm not. What?
Not tonight. Another time, perhaps.
We are. You've caught us at the tail end. We've got two more to go in this story arc. This is as I always talk about when I talk about our story arc structure. This is the one we realize we still have two more issues to go, so we come back swinging.
That's right.
We skate through the third one, and then by the fourth one, we're like, oh, we should pick it up again. And then by the fifth one, all bets are off. So
yeah, it's time to rock again. Here we go.
That's right. So we're back in business. Like I said, this is issue 126. It's the fourth issue of the story arc that Cole came up with. So I'm going to let him explain the story arc in short order to y'all.
I like how you just constantly this whole arc. It's like, oh, I'm just going to refer to you on this one.
I am.
But this is as you should know by now, should be well enamored of, I believe. This is the superhuman condition, where we're going to discuss some of the aspects, the psychology, the day-to-day,
the ornithology.
Reality, yeah, the ornithology, the etymology and entomology. So we want to know both the insects and the word forms, the origins of words for everything we talk about. You know, what it is to be a superhuman, and this is the issue where we're going to take human out of the equation, as it were, because this is out of this world.
I wish I had, like, weird Ed Wood noises to put in the back of that.
Like a theremin or something.
that was pretty good. I don't know whether you're a cat or a theremin.
That was actually a cat theremin.
I don't know why, Dr. Sylvania never invented the cat theremin.
I know.
itself.
You want to get really bizarre is the Schrodinger's cat theremin, which the difficult thing there is it may or may not actually even be there.
Right. If a cat is a theremin and a theremin is a box, and the cat theremin is in a box, will it make theremin noises when you run your hand close to it?
Or will your hand it noise would theremin make? So it becomes like one of those. You know, those, they might be giants, particle man things, you know. When he's in the water, does he get wet or does the water get him instead? That's obviously works very well with this particular line of inquiry for this episode, for this issue, because we're going to be looking at the alien races that have, that people comics.
Right.
And the kind of the superhuman condition of being a expatriate or explanatory, perhaps, if you will.
Yeah.
Hero or villain, or even, you know, in some cases even going beyond villainy, where it's just sort of naturally occurring despotism, for example.
Once you reach a certain point, once you are so far removed from the human race, or so powerful, or so, you know, Thanos-y or Darkseid-y, Or on the other side, I don't know if we've moved to that point yet, but maybe in the next one. But like beyondery, where it just doesn't even matter. Like your ethics, your code, your moral standing is so far beyond what we would consider, you know, human behavior that it doesn't even matter anymore.
Yes, exactly. Or even, you know, even if you've transcended your own species behavior.
Right. I do that every day. I've transcended human behavior in so many ways.
Well, this whole show is a testament to that. But
it's very true. It's very true. So the most obvious, like you said, like the most obvious is alien races.
Absolutely.
And I was
there's no shortage of them.
No. And that's what we were talking about, because I was in the car and we were discussing the show with Lacey and we were driving around and we were talking about when you know, when, because from pretty much from the beginning of my understanding of aliens in comic books, they've always been your Martian Manhunters, or were there ever any kind of just little green men or little gray men that you can think of that were kind of the nameless horde of, or that had names, but weren't like Martian Manhunter, where you're like, you know, here's a bandolier and a cape, go fight crime.
Yeah, I don't think you ever really saw anybody outside of your sci-fi, you know, Where Monsters Dwell, or Weird Things from Beyond Space, or, you know, titles like that. The first being Real, the second one being not even real sounding. Where you had, like, the first appearance of Groot. The original Groot was a massive tree beast from beyond space that came. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was one of those, you know, the classic fabled giant story, you know, where you outsmart the giant by making it hurl a rock, and then you hurl a...
You tie it, yeah.
Yeah, you hurl a pigeon or something that somehow is mistaken for a rock by the giant. You know, those things where you play a lot of simple tricks and
convince him to tie a rope to the rock, and you tie the rock to the rope to his leg, and then he throws himself off of the cliff type of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, little tricks like that, you know, where you give him a stone to squeeze, and you get a stone-shaped sponge, and you know, you see who's going to get the most water out of that, even if he has.
That's
like
a terrible.
It's one of those. I think it was one of those type of stories where, you know, some quick-witted but otherwise normal kind of guy outwits the massive and would-be conqueror Groot, who at least is good as his word.
Right.
So, you know, apart from, you know, your occasional throwaway characters, where Stan Lee himself, in the context of that type of story, said, you know, he would often just fart out names in scripts to Jack Kirby, and Kirby would just, you know, in turn come back with these amazing, bizarre-ass creatures.
Right.
Where it was like, you know, Gormu and
Lumo
and, you know, whatever... anti-disestablishmentariano.
Well, I was reading a little off topic, but I was reading my Nick Fury Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. Jim Stranko Jack Kirby omnibus the other day, and there's you know, it goes through, and it's just like, you know, Nick Fury fights Baron Von Strucker and hooks up with the Countess and hangs out with Dum Dum. And then Nick Fury fights this weird, you know, like what looks like the Asgardian destroyer with Kirby fins on his head. You know what I mean? Just some weird, and it's just like, oh yeah, it's just a robot. That's all. Just a robot. Like, that does not look like just a robot. That looks like a world destroying, you know, concoction from Jotunheim or something. But just a robot.
Just another robot.
Like, Jack Kirby, son of a bitch, you did it again. But yeah, nobody did more for alien beasts, or beasts in general, than Jack Kirby.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Jack Kirby defined the unworldly, the unearthly for Marvel. Be it, you know, other dimensions or other planets or what have you, it's this sort of, Kirby gave us everything.
I think, you know, and we've had a show on Jack Kirby, but I think that in that same respect, I think Jack Kirby informed not just comics and not just Marvel, but everybody, you know, as to what a lot of things, because if we look at a lot of the monsters that we see now, for instance, the kaiju that were in what was the movie Sons of Anarchy and
Pacific Rim.
Yeah, like a lot of that. Yes, a lot of that was Japanese inspired, but a lot of that also was Kirby Monster Island inspired. If you look at a lot of like the weird stubby legs and all that stuff. So I think that Kirby really informed us all as to what otherworldly, whether it be, you know, depths of the ocean or from outer space or crawling out of the center of the earth would end up looking like in our brains for the rest of our lives.
Exactly. And I think it's definitely still inspires to this day. And then we get into, like you say, you spoke of Martian Manhunter, and apparently if you're part of a race that lived actually on Mars.
Sure.
At apparently no one ever noticed.
It's just wandering around on Mars, no one knows.
Until your entire race died off to a man.
Right.
And you're the last one, and you're kind of hanging around moping, you know, you're like a whole Omega Man thing going on, except there's nobody to fight or anything.
Sitting on Martian sand dunes.
It's just red everywhere.
Just listening to Richard Marx.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden some kook down on Earth zaps you to Earth. And he knows how to get his machine to zap you from Mars to Earth, but not vice versa.
He also was smart enough to invent a machine that could zap you from Mars to Earth, but didn't realize that, you know, 20 years ago or 15 years ago or 10 years ago, you had an entire thriving race up there.
Yeah, I could have helped out there toward the end, got a few more of them out before it was too late, maybe.
Right.
But at any rate, however it happened.
we can Fox News that guy into the ground.
Yeah,
but,
here, poor John Johns, Long Johns or whatever, he gets himself zapped onto Earth. So he's the last of his kind, and he doesn't get to ever go home.
Right.
And inexplicably has problem with fire, but nothing else. Which sets him a way above the average human who has problem with fire and everything else. Unlike the rest of us, I'm tired of hearing him bitch about how he's vulnerable to fire. I'm vulnerable to fire, but I'm also vulnerable to bullets. So, there's a bit of a trade-off there.
And asphyxiation and walls.
Yeah, yeah. And people dropping dumbbells on my foot or rattlesnakes.
And that's there was a panel in it, and I think it was JLA. It was either JLA the Nail or JLA Year One, where there was the time in which Batman met John Jones, and you know it was one of the secret devil worshipping cults in Gotham, and John was on the case, and Batman shows up. And they find the cult at the same time. They're trying to rescue some kids. And they find the cult at the same time. And John shows some, you know, extraplanar abilities while he's still in his, gumshoe disguise.
Yeah.
And Batman catches on to it. And the place catches on fire. And this is after, you know, his Elastic Man, his Invisible Man, his I-beams, his, you know, any other thing he needs. And John is shrinking away from the fire, and Batman just turns around and, like, strikes a match and holds it up to him, and John's like, no! I'm like, really? He has that much of a psychotic reaction to fire? Are you kidding me with that? Like, what is he?
I guess, you know, the thing about it is, let's explore a little of the psychology of this particular alien, is that when you're invulnerable to everything else, when by accident, or design even, but more likely by accident, you're just blowing and going. People are like shooting you and throwing rocks and blowing things up, and which I guess strangely enough has fire element to it.
Right.
But you know, when you're invulnerable to everything and all of a sudden you get like, you know, you put your hand too close to the burner on an old gas stove and all of a sudden you're like, wow, the hey!
That's true.
You'll get a bit of a psychotic reaction around
the
that.
One that actually hurts.
You'll get a Victor Frankenstein's monster kind of reaction to fire. You know, you'd be like Peter Boyle here with his thumb on fire.
But the part of Martian Manhunter, they were dwelling on the Manhunter, but the part about Martian Manhunter that really cracks me up is it has to be really inconvenient to only use the boom tube to travel to the JLA Watchtower and back, because otherwise you're coming back through Earth's atmosphere, and all that is fire. It's just fire.
Well, it's got to be annoying, like, if Green Lantern's like, hey, let me give you a ride. Like, no, it's okay. I mean, I realize I'm safe, but it's still fire.
Exactly. Like, I can't fly in the invisible jet down there. I can't. I could probably go on my own. I could probably make it, you know, through some weird force field projection that they write into that particular story, I could probably make it from space to Earth, but I'm not going to do it because of the fire.
Yeah. It's always, it comes down to the fire, ultimately.
It does. It comes, it's like an Adele song. It always comes down to the fire.
So let's look at a few other famous aliens. I guess certainly the most famous is the one whose catchphrase I borrowed there with the that strange visitor who, as strange visitors go, is the least strange of them all.
It's true. It's true.
You know, anyone who can pass themselves off as just some kind of nerd, you know, it'd be like if Carl Sagan turned out to be an alien. I'd be less thinking that, well, yeah, he's a little odd, but not strange in the sense of, like, say, the Predators or
the Xenomorphs or something.
Yeah, you know, there are strange Groot, for God's sakes, a stranger, a visitor from another planet, should he come a-calling. So, you know, please bear that in mind when establishing
Groot. I like what you did there. It's like strange fruit, but strange Groot. I like it.
Yeah.
Well done.
As you'll find out at AllCon, everything is coming up Groot. I will leave it at that. if you attend one of my talk shows, you'll find out what that's all about.
And you will attend one of those talk shows. Yes, Superman. We, of course, speaking of Superman in this respect.
I was talking about Super Skrull.
Oh, were you?
Actually, Superman.
Super Skrull could pass himself off as a giant nerd, actually.
Yes, he could. But it's below him.
Literally. He's like 8 foot tall.
Yeah, it's just it's hard to do. He hasn't mastered, like, shrinking himself down. It's like everything he turns into is 8 feet tall.
It's a real dead giveaway.
That is the biggest pygmy hippopotamus I've ever seen. Didn't realize they came 8 feet tall.
Why is it on fire?
Yeah.
Why is that pygmy? Half of it's invisible.
It's funny that I didn't really notice that it was inflamed, but that it was just so big.
The thing that if anybody ever gets a chance with the Super Skrull to sit down and have a conversation with the Super Skrull about, you know, if anybody really gets to have that, Doc Samson gets to have his one-on-one with the Super Skrull, just tell him he doesn't have to use it all at once.
That's
he can
so
use
true.
One at a time. Yeah. He doesn't have to have a thin leg and a stretchy leg and an invisible arm and a fire arm.
Yeah, he's not Metamorpho. He's not Ultra the Multi-Alien.
Right, you're just tasking yourself. Just slow it down, buddy. But yes,
but that's really all about overcompensating.
It is. Well, insecurity. You know, he was the outcast in the Skrull community because he was so big.
Yeah.
Most of the Skrulls are like 4 foot nothing.
Yeah,
weigh about
easy.
80 pounds.
Four foot's a tall guy.
Yeah, right. That's the minute bull.
Yeah, they're like all like little bitty bug-eyed guys, and Super Skrull's got a pretty, you know, he's got that pronounced jaw going on.
Just 8 foot, 8 foot if he's a centimeter, and yeah. I don't know why I went metric system, but I did. And
well, actually, the Skrull use both interchangeably.
Oh, that's what makes them the superior race.
That's right.
And
it's really complex. It's like a lot of languages where, you know, it's like, you know, Vietnamese where a different pronunciation of the same looking word vastly changes the definition.
That's why every one of their invasions don't work when they try to come to New York, is because they're still in the metric system and they overshoot or they undershoot. It's just it's rough for them. They refuse to come to our system of measurement, and that's their problem.
Well, not fully, because they do keep interchanging
and their quiche. Their quiche are awful.
They'll bring the wrong set of screwdrivers.
That's true. They always bring the wrong hex set, and then they can't change a tire. It's a dead giveaway. If you ever meet somebody that doesn't have the right set, the right wrenches for a job, chances are they're a Skrull and you should kill them.
Yeah, that's right.
Straight away.
Just go ahead. I mean, in the cold light of morning, they may not turn out to be an alien after all, but it's better to play it safe.
Safe than sorry. Yep, absolutely.
So actually, yes, we are talking, of course, about Superman.
Who
has the unusual, unlike Martian Manhunter, he's the last of his kind, or so he thought, for the longest. But, you know, it's like Ciccolini. It's like, I don't remember. I was just a little baby. You know, he had to find out post facto, oh, by the way, let me wreck everything you ever knew. It's like your real dad showing up when you're 16. And, oh, by the way, yeah, you're, you know, exiled royalty, and you're...
exactly.
You've been living in a... like an old shack for all your life, but really, you know, back home, your mom and I have had been living in a palace. And we just had to... this is the way we do things, you know. It's like, thanks, Dad. I don't know why he embraced his Kryptonian culture so much. It seemed like the culture douches.
That's right. What's really funny is Ma and Pa Kent must have really, really, really raised him right. Because I don't know another... how old was he when he found out, give or take, depending on what origin story you...
yeah, I guess probably somewhere between 16 and 18.
What 16 to 18-year-old guy would find this out and not immediately use it to, like, go chase tail or, you know, become a stunt car driver or, you know, no, I'm going to do good. Really? That's what you're going to do? When I was 18, if I found out that I was the last Kryptonian and these were my powers and, you know, and Marlon Brando showed up in a weird, looking like the bad guy from Zoolander, looking like Will Ferrell from Zoolander outfit to tell me this stuff, I would have been like, F you, Dad.
Yeah. You're not my real daddy.
You're not my real dad. My real dad died in a weird tornado accident that I refused to save him from to protect myself. The weakest. That was weak.
Yes, well, we're all still stinging from that one.
It's supposed to be as fast as the Flash. Can't get in and out without being seen. I'm not buying it. but yeah, you're right. Like, what is that? What does that do to you? How do you end up that wholesome in that situation?
Yes, exactly.
Especially when your first friend is Batman. When your first real friend is Batman.
And I guess the idea there is that it's the enduring legacy of the Kents at work here. That they were such a vastly influence on him that they rendered young Clark in a perpetual state of living in the previous century, or by now 2 centuries ago.
Right. It's almost like a superpower in and of itself, his unassailable morality.
Yeah. That, quite frankly, is impossible. It should never remotely exist in any way, shape, or form.
You know, we had talked on the phone earlier when we were getting ready to do the show about... are there any alien races that are less than humans? You know, essentially, like that, because we all have the Marshmanners and the Supermans and the whoevers that come to Earth and they're greater thans.
Yes.
Are there any less thans? And the only one I can come close with is are the Microns.
Ah, yes, formerly of the Micronauts, and then in the unlicensed version.
But if I remember correctly, they essentially had superpowers. They would have been fine if they were a little bigger. If they could come out of it.
In their own world, a Kreuer was a badass.
Right.
And I don't know if it was like, you know, Micron Plus or, you know, if it was his armor or himself or a combination thereof. But he was, you know, he was of a warrior people.
Yes.
And, in a sense, the micro world they would eventually go on to reveal was like this one of those little molecule models that dresses the set of every science
right,
you know, in any sitcom where a scientist has an office, there's always some sort of molecular model there. They actually lived on a riboflavin nucleotide that was actually their planet. So, but it was sort of structured like, you know, each there were like all these like 9 or 10 different individual planets all interconnected by a linking by one of those Tootsie Toy linking bars.
Yeah,
like molecules are done in real life,
like a little piece of dowel.
Yeah. Yeah, they all have their own little, so it's sort of like almost like if you go look up Xandar, how that was structured, where it was a bunch of asteroids all linked together with two habitrail tubes.
Yes.
Look it up. God's truth.
I know.
But the thing about it was I don't think for the most part they were just like they were like Star Wars guys. They just all were pretty robust and adventuresome types, but they weren't necessarily imbued with the mega strength or superpowers apart from Force of Croyer.
Right. So yeah, so that was my trying to think of a.
But yeah, that's a good point, because they, and while they weren't necessarily extraterrestrial, I think extra-dimensional would certainly fall into this as well, which does bring up a point about, you know, other extra-dimensional sources, like the Negative Zone, or, you can't really count the, not the Forbidden Zone, that's Planet of the Apes, but you can't count the,
Negative Zone?
No, where Zod and his...
The Phantom Zone.
Yeah, I can't count the Phantom Zone.
There's so many zones.
I know. But you really can't count that because the Phantom Zone, they're technically extraterrestrials made extra-dimensionals.
Right, right. You know, there are... well, what about... Because I want to hear your take on the Brood.
Ah, the Brood.
Because the Brood is very obviously a ripoff. Just a blatant wholesale ripoff of Xenomorphs, right? I'm not wrong.
No, it was certainly Claremont and company were, and possibly even some mandate from Marvel themselves to, you know, a lot of what you find in comics is driven by what's going on in popular culture.
Right.
You see a lot of that sort of thing happen where, you know, something's big in popular culture, it's going to start to appear elsewhere. It's like the monster family moving in next door to the Flintstones, you know, because shows like The Munsters and The Addams Family were popularized. And so essentially, you know, it's not that big a surprise that that happened. But at the same time, it was one of the more blatant sort of nods to something going on out in the world. And, yeah, the Brood were designed to be like a thinking, talking alien xenomorphs.
Right.
They were the ones who were going to, you know, that way you could actually have some sort of interaction with them and some reasonable discourse, potentially.
Which never ever happened. I don't think that.
But essentially, they were just like some sort of weird, ever apparently universally fertile wasps going around impregnating hosts with eggs.
Right.
That then, oddly enough, reordered their DNA and turned them into brood as well.
Well, later it was. In later incarnations of the Brood, they full-on popped out of people.
Oh, okay.
Like, they gestated, and then...
Let's go all in.
Right. They went all in,
at one point, you know, Wolverine gets... naturally, he's going to be the one who takes the bullet, because he's the one who can survive it. And, you know, the dynamics of that alone were kind of awkward.
Right.
At best, I can't really remember 100% of what was going on here.
It happened again recently too, during the death of Wolverine, where he found a baby brood, in area the Weapon X facility where he was going after the professor and found it, and it happened again. He opened it up. And because it was like this cute little alien thing, and then it came after him and it got inside of him and he had to kill it, and you know,
of course.
I mean, it's a brood. What do you expect?
Yeah, but the Brood were an interesting plot device, if nothing else. And the thing about it is, just talking about aliens in general in comics, one of the things that's always struck me is, it seems like every now and again there just aren't enough aliens.
Right.
And if you look at the sheer volume of alien races that occurred in the Marvel Universe, some of them stuck, some of them didn't. It just seems like one of the things that always bothered me is, why so damn many? And why do some sort of fall out of fashion? I mean, the Kree and the Skrulls have the staying power. They've been around forever.
Right.
But, like, if you go over to DC, the Dominion, I don't know if they were completely wiped out. I got so tired of them inside a month. And they stuck around for, like, 6 years. And not that I'm missing them. I just wonder if they just disappeared completely. But one of the things that I really liked, and I think we've talked about this on the show before, is in the Teen Titans when they went to fight for Coriander's homeworld.
Mm-hmm.
And there were four or five distinct alien races that appeared throughout that entire plot line.
Right.
In varying degrees. You had these big green lizard guys who were like the soldiery. You had the Scions who were like the science guys. You had the big bulbous jet black fez wearing guys who were like sort of the fish's ruler types. And you had these kind of snaggletooth, four-armed purple guys who just kind of got all the other jobs nobody wanted.
Snaggletooth hunchback jobs.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm starting to notice a trend.
There seems to be something going on there. But, you know, the thing about it was that those races specifically were distinct throughout the entire thing. You'd occasionally see some other races as well. But, you know, anytime there's some kind of big intergalactic crossover event, 90% of the previously encountered alien races just seem to fall off the face of the universe.
Right. It waxes and wanes like the mutants did, you know, where there'd be a big build up and then all of a sudden, okay, that threat's over. We're gonna let that go for a while. Yeah, or they need a, you know, there was a period of time when they had what, 5-6 major crossovers within a year, and then that one giant company-wide crossover per year. Yeah. So they needed to gin up some enemies quick, yeah. some extinction-level events on the regular. How, what better to do that than just create a race of aliens to attack that don't, you know...
They had never seen before.
And we'll never see again.
Exactly, and what's wrong with the ones that were already there? You know?
Like, but, for instance, the bloodline parasites.
Oh, yeah, and in many cases, the ones you never see again, it's probably for the best.
Oh, by far for the best. by far for the best. But there are some that have stuck around. And of those, who is your favorite of the ones that are just perennially there?
Of course, I'll always have a special place in my heart for the Skrulls, because there's just something both unique and annoying about the Skrulls, in that their shape-shifting ability, I remember it was suggested by John Byrne in the pages of Fantastic Four during his tenure that their ability to shape-shift was actually sort of projected empire-wide upon them. It was actually technological, not natural.
Oh, okay.
And something happened to the main generator, and it caused everybody to be pretty much stuck the way they were. And one of the scenes to illustrate this was like the this piece of artsy-fartsy something that was a gift from the Skrull ambassador to some planet, an alien race you would never see again. You know, the ruler or whoever it was that was looking at this thing suddenly glowing and remarking on how the gift from the Skrull ambassador is strangely glowing. One of the things that struck me there is the gift from the Skrull ambassador is going to stink on ice in about a week. Because it's going to be hard for that guy to get any sustenance if he's, you know, shaped like some sort of weird sculpture.
Exactly. You need a mouth. You need a mouth and a functional stomach to...
Well, and also grabbing hands to, you know, get at the snacks that may be in grabbing reach, you know?
Yeah.
So I always felt sorry for that one. But the Skrulls were kind of a unique thing, because you had the shapeshifter thing, but in their natural Skrull form, they were also kind of unique. I mean, they could have just had them be blue-skinned or red-skinned or green-skinned. But to have them, you know, have the big pointy ears and the tiny little bodies and the big bug eyes and the Kirby multi-cleft chin. It was right up into their lips, the Thanos now, thing going on.
What was the gardens, the hanging gardens, essentially, of the chin?
Yeah, it is. They're like the Babylon of chins.
Babylon of chins.
You know, Bruce Campbell has nothing to complain about anymore. We talk about if chins could kill.
That's right. These chins literally, probably in their power set, were able to kill.
Exactly. And then, you know, I don't know, gosh, some of the other alien races that are prevalent. There's so darn many of them, they kind of get lost in the shuffle, but...
See, I was always a fan of the Shire.
Oh,
or the
yeah.
Shire, or Shire, however...
Shire.
I don't know if they're bird people or just an aspect of the bird.
Apparently they're... If nothing else, they... apparently their heads express feathers instead of hair.
Okay. And apparently that's a huge turn-on for Professor X.
Obviously, he has no hair, but damn, he has no feathers either, so you know what I'm talking about.
He has no feathers.
Plus, it was like, it was kind of like Bo Pilgrim of Pilgrim's Pride. He'd been messing with chickens for years, so. I can see.
Wow.
Sort of an avian fetish going on there that, but yeah, that's a neat race too, because they do have the featherhead going on, and I guess in some illustrations of them, they even seem to be expressing some feather-like protrusions from their elbows.
Or and did they just have nothing better wings. To do? Did they have nothing better to do than just to hunt the brood? Because that kind of was at the same time, right?
The brood kind of showed up, and I guess, you know, when the brood come into town, that's the best thing to do is just get hunting.
Yeah, that's all you can really do.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was when space was big. Space was really, really big. That's when the X-Men spent, like, 4 years in space, and the Justice League was constantly going to space. I think the Avengers spent quite a bit of time in space. Like,
the Avengers used to go, because they went and got, you know, inserted Earth's foot into the middle of the Kree-Skrull War.
That's true.
I don't know where, what strategic value that had for Earth, but...
Yeah.
To me, it seemed like one of those aliens versus predator, whoever wins, we lose sort of equations.
This will never come back to bite us in the
ass.
That's
right.
But I know there's...
You see Ronan the Accuser coming in and saying, you chose to side with the Skrull. No, we actually sided with you because of our friend Captain Marvel.
We couldn't tell. Well, so much was happening.
So what? I'll find something to accuse you of. That's what I do.
I know that one... Ronan the issue laden. Ronan the in need of therapy. No other comic really during its prime, and I'm not talking recently or in the last 10 years, because it's gotten really ridiculous in the last 10 years.
Oh yeah.
But in its prime, the Green Lantern Corps comics.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Really explored what it meant to be alien better than, you know, and Alan Moore. We've talked about it, and I kind of want to talk about it again. Alan Moore really, you know, dug deep into this idea with your favorite story, and I think probably my favorite, you know, a separate favorite stories by him, or at least influenced by him. As in regards to how different it is to be alien, you know?
Yes.
And I think yours was... Go ahead and talk about yours, because yours is one of my favorite things, and I like to hear you talk about it, so...
Absolutely. You're talking about the Swamp Thing issue, or the...
I'm talking about the...
Or the Green Lantern Corps story that he wrote.
The Cetaphil issue.
Yes.
Or the
Cetaphil in the pages of Swamp Thing. Yeah, during Swamp Thing's intergalactic exile, which also did a lot to explore the idea of... You know, the in-depth look at the psychology of being on another world, being of another world, and it was during that time that Swamp Thing was jumping planet to planet, and he hit the home planet of Cetaphil, and was basically, you know, when he jumped into the green, this was an opposite world.
Right.
Where, you know, he, everything, all of life was, all of sentient life was in the green and...
not in the red.
Not in all of, yeah, they would like, you know, all the, that was red, all the, were effectively non-sentient, non, for the most part, non-moving type of things, like plants would be here. And so when he arrives, he basically, you know, becomes this construct of thousands of people, or thousands of individuals, I guess you could say. And they become a collective consciousness during that time. And Cetaphil has to come and literally selectively use the power of the ring to selectively remove each one until he whittles this monstrosity down into the essence of Swamp Thing.
That's awesome.
Which he then places inside the remains of his dead mentor. So he can have one of those AI last minute half hour with somebody you cared about.
Right.
In a sense. And but what was really fascinating about that is it took you inside this newly created hive mind, because you had a characters that he'd concentrated on, like a couple who were drifting apart. You had a holy man who'd lost his faith. You had a number of individuals, and for the first time, an alien race's individuality had been explored fairly in depth, where normally they become archetypes. You know, you just sort of look at Skrulls as all being little beady-eyed shapeshifting little creeps.
Right.
That you know, you see all the Kree as just being like, this is Sparta, you see. But you rarely get to see that type of individuality explored, and that type of just little day-to-day life, and through the process of becoming part of their entire community, you know, this holy man regains his faith, this couple find that they were in fact drifting apart and cannot reconcile. And so it's not all happy endings as a result either, because they're suddenly thrust into a big picture situation. And it was one of those fascinating explorations of the psychology of being other than human.
Also, you were a big fan, and this just dawned on me while I was here, the other story you were talking about, I believe, was the F. Bell Sharp story, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, the F. Sharp Bell, yes.
Yeah,
oh,
F. Sharp Bell.
Oh, my gosh. That, yeah, that to conceptualize an entity who lives in a world without light, has never known and never would know light and subsequently color, and being chosen to join an intergalactic league of protectors whose their very essence is based on color and light.
Yeah.
And that was a brilliant story as well, where Cap Matui, I believe, was charged with recruiting this character and having to adapt the whole concept of the Green Lantern into a sound-based.
Yeah.
And reconfiguring everything from light to sound, and becoming F-Sharp Bell instead of Green Lantern, and even right down to having an oath that
right.
fit the same timbre.
It's amazing, and you know, that's one of those things that we talk about Alan Moore and what he's done, and it's stories like that that if you haven't read them, and if you don't walk away from this episode with anything else, it's pick up. And what was the name of the? Because I have it too. The collected.
It's like the DC Stories of Alan Moore, something like that.
It's like the essential Alan. It's like it's a trade paperback. You know, it's not hardcover, it's softcover, but it includes those stories. It also includes my favorite Alan Moore story, which is the Mogo Don't Socialize.
Yes.
Which tells the story of what if you're not the last of your race. What if, as far as you know, you're the only member
exactly.
of your race that's ever existed? You know, it's the story of Mogo, the Green Lantern planet, of which, you know, all of the Green Lantern rings are dispersed from when they have to pick a new you know, a new person to represent a particular space sector, but a bounty hunter comes to the planet looking for Mogo. At this point, you don't know what Mogo is. Alan Moore had invented it. You know, he comes to this planet looking for this Green Lantern Mogo to bring him down, to bring him in.
And he's like almost like an analog to Lobo, in that he's this ultimate warrior, or mm-hmm. so he fancies himself, and he has come to track down the legendary Mogo, the greatest of the Green Lanterns. You know, what greater challenge, what greater prey?
Right. Only to find out that Mogo isn't a person. Mogo is the planet.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's how Mogo deals with that. And the last line is, you know, Mogo doesn't socialize. Mogo, yeah. Mogo doesn't mess around. Mogo's a planet. Mogo doesn't see things the way that you see things. Mogo is different than you. And I think that that's my, beside the...
Well, also within that, it's called DC Universe.
Okay.
The Stories of Alan Moore.
And okay.
Yeah, highly recommend it, because every single story in there is just amazing. And it's just his essence, his touch in so many aspects of the DC Universe. And there's a story that he wrote for, like, God, like Atari Force or something like that.
Right.
I can't remember what it was. But it's this wonderful little vignette about, it may have been for Omega Men or something like that, where it's basically this, you know, star-spanning empire that has come to take over, you know, every planet in the galaxy, and it's almost like the Screwtape Letters, and it's this this log of this, you know, the custodian of this completely desolate planet, and all of the work that's going on, and in the shadow of these colossi,
right,
that seem to be like just a pair of Auguste Rodin's The Thinker, sitting forever on this vast, empty, desolate plain, and you know, all this vast, long history of this race on this planet, and then at the end of the story, it's sort of revealed that all of that was nothing. They'd never conquered this world because these two statues were existing on a whole different time scale and a whole different plane of reality, almost.
Wow.
You know, that this entire eons pass by in the blink of an eye in the perception of these giants. And that was another one where it really kind of touched on the psychology, especially of the, you know, the intergalactic empire, the star-spanning empire, and the meaninglessness of it all, in the greater scheme of things. It was,
yeah,
like, you know, I always say there's so much can be learned from little throwaway lines in movies, and in the movie Crocodile Dundee, talks about how, you know, arguing over who owns land is like two fleas arguing over who owns the dog they live on.
It's a good line.
Yeah, so it's just...
but yeah, pick that up.
Yeah,
pick
it's, that it's book just up. Chock full of good... good reading.
And there's, as we come up against the end of the show, there's one other group that I think deserves mention, because aliens, you know, aliens are great, but if we're talking about, you know, something between man and the gods, man and you know, man and Thor, man and Odin, there have been a plethora of kind of entry level, I'll call them entry level, entry-level angels and demons that have made it to Earth.
That's so true. And the extra-dimensional and the extra... whatever...
like is. Extra-planetary type beings. So you've got guys like we were talking about Azrael, the one from the Justice League, who is
yeah.
kind of thrown out of heaven and had to end up fighting a war... a war for heaven, and then you've got the other side of that, which I think is the more prevalent because it's just more fun to talk about and write, which is the demon side, the bad side. Your
yes.
guys like Spawn and Hellboy. Like Hellboy is probably one of the coolest in some respects analogs to Superman that I've ever read, because you got the same idea. He came through as a child and was raised under the auspices of of, you know, a human adult caretaker, you know, and brought into a world that that was different and strange, and he didn't fit in at all, and he didn't fit in visually. You know, at least Clark Kent had that going for
him.
Yeah,
at least he could go get a job. You know, Hellboy has to go be a ward of the state. And...
Right. He has a giant rock hand and some carries a gun the size of my head. That really limits your employment possibilities. Guys like Ghost Rider. Ghost Rider's a super interesting version of Shazam. You know, like normally you're a rootin' tootin' stunt driver, except when you're in the presence of, you know, evil, and then you just get a giant flaming skull on your head, and you can turn, you know, your bike into a hell cycle.
Like, that's flaming wheels.
Right. Like, what is that? I mean, how do you deal? Do you deal with that? How do you deal with that? I mean,
or in the case of like the Demon Etrigan, who's been a part of the DC universe since as far back as anyone can remember. You know, there are tales of Etrigan working with Merlin and in the court of King Arthur within the context of the DCU. So these sort of extra, dimensional, but, you know, extra reality type characters from beyond...
From beyond our existence. Yeah. From beyond our, yeah.
And, you know, Etrigan's a fascinating character as well, in that, you know, speaking of a Shazam-type analog, where you have a character who is effectively possessed or is taken over, imbued as the vehicle through which this entity enters our plane of existence. And, again, going back to Alan Moore, and I may have talked about this on the show before, fascinating take on anything the man touches. He'll find a unique way to spin, and frankly wrote Etrigan the Rhyming Demon better than almost anyone ever had in his rhymes. But in the pages of Swamp Thing, Jason Blood appears during the American Gothic storyline.
Okay.
And he encounters Abigail Arcane and is describing the relationship that he has with Etrigan, and this is just, you know, God, this most brilliant thing in the world. He talks about how, you know, in the course of the story, Jason Blood is just a complete ass.
Right.
And, you know, I think he's confronted on this. He talks to her about how Etrigan, being a demon, is imbuing his own aspect upon his human host.
Right, rubbing off on him.
Yeah, so he struck a deal with Etrigan that they, if Etrigan was going to come and meddle with the affairs of man, that they would become more like each other.
Okay.
And he warns her, never be careful when you make a deal with a demon, because they're very shrewd, in that he himself, Jason Blood, is becoming more like Etrigan.
Right.
And Etrigan is becoming more like Jason Blood, becoming more like Etrigan. And I thought, what a beautifully demonic catch 22.
Right. Yeah, because Jason Blood was a kind of a hack sorcerer that stumbled upon this intonation, this ability to bring forth this demon. The demon tricks him into bonding with him. Because Etrigan is a trickster demon, and therein, you know, lies the history of the character. So he's constantly trying to work an angle, essentially.
Oh, yeah. And like, the other thing that was an odd thing, because I don't think anyone ever explored the psychology of a demon before.
Right. Right.
And to imbue him with that kind of psychology, which also plays on, I think, later after Abigail is abducted into hell and Etrigan is ultimately returns as the guide, as Swamp Thing's essence travels first to heaven and then to hell through the auspices of the Phantom Stranger. And,
which we'll talk about that next time.
Yeah, we'll
the Phantom Stranger will be the next episode. Yeah,
but there's an interesting little thing with the where the Stranger plucks a flower on the slopes of heaven before leading Swamp Thing down to the edges of hell where he has to depart. And Etrigan, being a demon, naturally has to strike a bargain for anything.
Yeah.
And in exchange for helping find Abigail, his price is the flower that the stranger had plucked and placed in his lapel.
Ah.
And they question, why? What would a demon want with a flower from heaven? He says, because its beauty is so vast, he of course does it in rhyme, brilliant rhyme, that hell will seem bleaker still.
That's amazing. Other,
yeah, the concept of bringing something so beautiful, so perfect, a tiny piece of heaven into hell, will make all of the denizens of hell the more tortured by its mere presence. Good night. And just completely blown away by that one. So, and that's one of the things you don't really get to see a lot of the psychology of these extra-dimensional or extra-planal, type of
right.
beings, because, you know, nobody really looks at what's driving a nihilist or...
It's
usually just anger and resentment about, you know, being brutalized or tortured or just waking up hateful.
You just waking up hateful. But you have a lot of these races, a lot of these people, I mean, you get into the ones that they're almost viral. You know, and that is another, there's another story that I wanted to mention, and then we'll start wrapping it up. And that's the story of Despotalis. And Despotalis was speaking of Green Lanterns, he was a Yellow Lantern.
Okay, I thought Despotalis was something they advertised on, like from Pfizer or something.
It is.
Ask your doctor if Despotalis is right for you.
Can cause blindness.
they cause blindness or expulsion of flaming barf.
Well, that is a visual. Despotalis, there was a Green Lantern that... He got issued to go to a sector, and his sector, all these planets were getting wiped out, and he would always get there as it was happening. He'd get there, and then all of a sudden this planet was getting wiped out, and he could never catch the Yellow Lantern that was doing it.
Wow.
So planet to planet, he was going from planet to planet trying to catch, whatever planet he was on, the Green Lantern the Yellow Lantern seemed to have been there, just wiping out the entire populace, billions dead, and he couldn't figure it out. Finally, he goes to a planet and he calls upon the ring, and he has the ring do like full spectral analysis instead of just like, you know, show me the Yellow Lantern, and then it was too late.
Yeah.
Despotalis is a sentient, basically a sentient hyper bubonic plague virus.
Ah, okay, so it was always there.
It attached itself to him.
Oh, so any planet he went to, he was subsequently killing.
He was the patient zero for that virus, and he would kill the
infected. He was the vector.
Yeah, and he had to live in his last, death throes. As Despotalis finally came for him and turned the virus on him, he had to live with the knowledge that he was the reason that all these planets were dying.
Yes.
It was just a sentient virus, and once the Yellow Lantern, once the ability to institute great fear was put into him, he was given purpose. But, there's a lot of that almost viral idea. Like you mentioned, Annihilus and his Annihilus wave. They were almost viral. Their whole purpose they weren't angry. They weren't mad. Annihilus was, but his brood wasn't. Their whole purpose was just to devour and continue.
Yeah, and much like the mindless ones that would occasionally get unleashed from some mythical realm.
Dr. Strangian.
Yes.
The Stygian Void.
Indeed.
But yes, so do you have any final thoughts on this guy, on this show?
I think that this one is... Of the ones of the aspects of this, the various facets of this particular arc, I think this is the one that's going to need even further exploration, because there are so darn many alien races. There's so many angles on the idea of the alien race, from intergalactic empires to freebooting adventurers from beyond space. And,
right.
And one of the most bothersome things is, and this is something we really need to tackle on another show, is the idea of a single representative of seven different races in a group, of whom you never see any of the other members of that constituent race.
Give me an example.
Like, for example, the Omega Men.
Okay.
Where you might, had Tigor and Harpus and other very derivative names for these aliens that fit nicely into proper Earth English.
Right.
And you would never again see a representative, in most cases, of their particular race. And another example in a different vein is that I always had trouble with was the idea of, like, say, a race-specific or a species-specific power.
Okay.
Like, say, magnetism or...
So you're talking about the Legion of Superheroes
there, syndrome. Yeah, now I'm going into the Legion of Superheroes.
Right.
Where everybody on the planet has that power. And nobody ever seems to think, well, that's all well and good, except that anyone who comes here from your planet has the exact same power. You only get to be Cosmic Boy by virtue of being the first.
Yeah, did you get the short straw or the long straw?
And the only time I ever saw someone really effectively address that was during, I think it was called Invasion, was the big crossover, and the Daxamites make it to Earth. The Daxam was invented because Krypton was blowed up.
Okay.
And you needed, at some point, somebody felt they had to have a Superman analog in this Legion of Superheroes other than Superboy.
All right.
And that would be Mon-El.
Yes. Yes.
Strangely had a very Kryptonian-esque name.
Right.
And ultimately what that translates into is you get, effectively Daxam and Krypton were identical type of planets. They were both red suns. And,
okay.
And so the yellow sun effect was in play. So Mon-El shows up and he's like Superman new. New and improved Superman. Well, for the Invasion, what was pretty cool was that they had the Daxamites arrive en masse as part of the Invasion. They all disembark from their ship, and suddenly it's like in the Weak Death of Pa Kent movie. There's this realization that they have this tremendous power at their disposal.
Yes.
So they're all like, preparing to disembark and walk off the plane and or off the ship, and suddenly they're flying off the ship. They're just flush with this new superpower. And I thought that was a really clever approach to
doing it.
Yeah, to, doing something with everybody from your planet has the same power.
Right. Well, we will revisit that, and I just added it to our list. So it lives on the living document now. So
right.
So we'll get to it. But we are out of time for this issue. Next issue is called what, Cole?
The next issue, the final issue of this is suddenly it escapes me. The Gods Themselves.
There you go. It's going to be a good one.
It was taken from the title of a science fiction novel, and I suddenly couldn't remember the damn name.
And then after that, it's
Isaac Asimov's The Gods Themselves.
And after The Gods Themselves, ladies and gentlemen, you better hold on tight. And if you're in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, you better get yourself to Addison.
Yes, indeed.
because we will be having a live recording of Hey Kids Comics, as well as a live recording of Hey Kids Comics Live, as well as a live recording of the Jedi Cole universe, as well as a live recording of everything that you could possibly imagine.
Yeah, there'll be more things going on, and as I've said before, there's it's chock-a-block full of amazing game shows. There's the perennial favorite Don't Lose Your Geek Card is back with all manner of incarnations, including a comic book edition, a Star Wars edition, even a B-movie edition this year.
That's going to be awesome. That's going to be awesome. And, Roy's hosting that thing, and he's going to do a heck of a job.
Yes, and of course, we have your show, Onliners, is returning for the second year of just amazing. More shows of Onliners than last year, more shows of Screen Time, more shows of shows.
It's right.
Of course, my Sunday morning talk show returning for its sixth or seventh big year. I've lost track now. Jedi Cole's Morning After. So there's just no end of amazing to be had at AllCon. Visit all-con.net. You can find out about that and other conventions at Convention Awareness Project Texas at cap-tx.info. You can find us, of course, on the Jedi Cole Universe at jedicole.com.
You can.
You can write to us at jcumail@yahoo.com. You can look for the occasional tweets, of which I'll start to have some more soon, on Twitter.
You've been getting better.
The Jedi Cole View. I'm getting a little better at that.
Yeah.
And we're going to be having a lot more content on the Jedi Cole Universe YouTube page, especially with AllCon coming up. And after this, I'm back to work on AllCon some more. So we'll have plenty of stuff for you guys to see. Some amazing. You can find out how everything's coming up. Groot. You can find out about some great new breakfast cereals that may or may not exist. And
you can find it. It's seriously, if there's anything you're into, come to AllCon. You're gonna be entertained. You're gonna enjoy it.
Absolutely. And remember, it's a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday show. It's the 12th, I believe. Is that right? Yes.
The 12th through the 15th.
If you're curious, you just want to check it out, come out all day. The 12th is free. Free admission all day long. And there's programming all day long. You're gonna buy a ticket. You're going to buy a 3-day pass or 4-day pass. So you may as well just go ahead and buy it now. But if you're curious and you just want to check it out, if you've never been to AllCon, it's a free day. Come out, check it out, spend the day, enjoy all the programming. You really do have to kind of pick and choose what you're going to do, because there's more stuff in any given hour than you can possibly do in an hour.
That's right. That's right. And not to mention the fact that are you going to have another Rantcore Pit Live before that?
Yes, it will. We will have one more Rantcore Pit Live the weekend before, the Sunday before AllCon weekend.
Nice.
Out of deepelemonair.com.
There you go.
With myself and Eddie Medina. We're having to bump our next Hey Kids Comics Live by a week, because we're going to be at AllCon.
But we're going to do one live there, too.
Yeah,
we'll be doing
something live there, but it won't be on Deep Elm.
It won't be on, but trust that it's going to end up on the YouTube channel. You can have faith in that fact.
Absolutely.
All right, I think we talked these people's ears off long enough. So we'll let them go. As always, buy, collect, and enjoy your comic books. And while it is out of print, what was the name of it again? It was DC Universe, Alan Moore.
Yeah, the Stories of Alan Moore.
Yeah, that, make that a priority. If you can get your hands on that, do it in a heartbeat. It is worth every cent. It's one of the most poignant collections of stories in comic form that I have ever had the pleasure of reading. So, well, I guess with that, say goodnight, Cole.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody, and we'll talk to you from the great beyond next time. That was good. Was that Schrodinger's?
That was it.
Or it may not have been Schrodinger's airman cat. Like a lover beside your